instinctively expect. Attention to you means engaged focus on you. It means sensitivity to your needs and feelings. Did your parents pay at least as much attention to you as they did to the TV? Did your father notice and attend to your feelings and fears with the same care that he showed his car? Did he ever concentrate on you for as long as he did on a ball game? Watching your every move, even if it comes from a desire to protect you, is not attention, but intrusion or surveillance. In truly loving attention, you are noticed, not scrutinized. Overprotectiveness is a rejection of your power and thus of you. Authentic attention comes to you anytime, not just when you present a problem. Such statements as, children should be seen, not heard, are odious to a parent committed to paying attention to his child. One of the characters in a J.D. Salinger novel says, "My father turned to me as if he had been waiting all his life to hear my question. Was I listened to like that? Did I matter that way?" If we missed out on attention when we were children, we might have learned to attend to ourselves, to become more and more creative, to look for attention from adults other than our parents. In this way, a deficiency became something beneficial, the pothole that became the portal. Likewise, our ability to reach out as adults may be directly proportional to our recognition that what we needed in our childhood was not there to be had. Seeing that deficiency in the past will help us see it in a present relationship and not keep looking for something that we need in a container that is empty. Attunement is attentiveness that is mirrored from one person to another. Attentiveness means noticing and hearing words, feelings, and experience. In a moment of authentic attention, we feel that we are deeply and truly understood in what we say or do, and in who we are. Nothing left out. Likewise, we can attune to others' feelings, needs, bodily reactions, comfort levels with closeness, degrees of willingness, for example, whether someone is acting out of coercion and compliance rather than true concurrence. We cannot tune in on someone if we assume certain feelings are right and others wrong. To attune to someone, we need neutrality toward all feelings and moods, toward inner states, and a fearless openness, what comes in mindfulness. Only with such pure attention can we see beyond bravado to terror, beyond stolidity to turmoil. This is how attention becomes compassion through attunement. Whatever in us has failed to find attunement stays folded up within us or becomes a source of shame. Faulty attunement in early life may lead to fear of standing up for ourselves later, or keep us from trusting that others will come through for us. Faulty attunement can make us scared and lonely, too. We fear exposing some regions of our psychic topography because of our inbred despair of ever finding the requisite human mirroring. But attuned attention creates an ever-widening zone of trust and safety. We feel encouraged to look for, rather than wait for, our submerged longings to emerge and our stunted hopes to assume their full dimensions. We believe they will be attended to at last. This is love in the form of mindful attention, and we feel safe in it. Implicit in such attentiveness to our truth is truth from the one providing it. We trust him to say what is true for him. And that is where our sense of safety comes from. The first A is the core of mindfulness. Attention means bringing something or someone into focus, so it is no longer blurred by the projections of your own ego. Thus, it requires genuine interest and curiosity about the mysterious and surprising truth that is you. A parent or partner who has gotten to know you in a superficial way may only be meeting up with her beliefs about you. Those beliefs or biases can endure for years, preventing the person from taking in the kind of information that would reveal the real you. The real you is an abundant potential, not a list of traits, and intimacy can only happen when you are always expanding in others' hearts, not pigeonholed in their minds. Our identity is like a kaleidoscope. With each turn, we reset it, not to a former or final state, but to a new one that reflects the here and now positions of the pieces we have to work with. The design is always new because the shifts are continual. That is what makes kaleidoscopes and us so appealing and beautiful. Parents and partners who give us attention love to see the evolving kaleidoscope of us. The desire for attention is not a desire for an audience, but for a listener. Attention means focusing on you with respect, not with contempt or ridicule. When you are given attention, your intuitions are treated as if they matter. You are taken seriously. You are given credit when it is due. Your feelings have such high value to those who love you that they are on the lookout for them. They even look for the feelings you are afraid to know, and they gently inquire whether you want to show them. When others give you attention, they also confront you directly when they are displeased, harboring no secret anger or grudges. But they always do this with respect and a sincere desire to keep the lines of communication open. Attention, like the other four A's, is given in a trusting atmosphere of holding. Acceptance. In Buddhism, there is a phrase, the glance of mercy, which refers to looking at other human beings with acceptance and understanding. Acceptance means we are received respectfully with all our feelings, choices, and personal traits and supported through them. This makes us feel safe about knowing and giving ourselves to others. Our ability to be intimate grows in accordance with how safe we feel, and that safety is based primarily on how authentically we were accepted in early life. But even after we grow up, moments and months of acceptance by other adults can fill in some of what we may have missed as children, so that intimacy is still an option for all of us. As with all the five A's, it is never too late to find acceptance or to learn to show it. If we lacked acceptance in childhood, we might have felt ashamed or inadequate, but we also might have compensated for the lack in a positive way by finding a center of evaluation in ourselves, thus becoming less dependent on others' approval. So now as adults, we are swayed neither by criticism nor by flattery. We learned early on to ground our self-worth in the depths of our own psyche. This not only builds our self-esteem, but also makes it easier for us to accept others. Since we are not trying to get something from them, we can appreciate them and accept them as they are. How much my parents missed out on when they could not let this happen between us. To accept their children, parents must be free of preconceived plans or agendas for them. These parental representations can begin before birth and range from, this will be a boy, to, this baby will be a spark plug in our marriage. He will make it work. Or, this girl will do what I couldn't do. Each is a subtle rejection of our individuality, with its limitations and potentials. Parents can accept us only after they succeed in dismantling their original representation of us in favor of the person we are turning out to be. This means not being disappointed with us for breaking a bargain we never made. Acceptance is unconditional, since it means validating someone's choices and lifestyle even when we do not agree with them. It is the opposite of moralizing. Acceptance is a style of pure mindfulness. We see all that is and feel all that we feel about what is, but then we focus only on what is as it is. Acceptance is approval, a word with a bad name in some psychologies. Yet it is perfectly normal to seek approval in childhood and throughout life. We require approval from those we respect. Approval is a necessary component of self-esteem. It becomes a problem only when we give up our true self to find it. then approval seeking works against us. In attention, you are heard and noticed. In acceptance, you are embraced as worthy. Not compared to your siblings, but trusted, empowered, understood, and fully approved of as you are in your own uniqueness. You sense a kindly support of your path, no matter how unusual, of your feelings, no matter how disturbing, of your deficiencies, no matter how irritating. These are not only tolerated, but encouraged and cherished. You are perfectly you, and that is enough. Rather than expecting you to meet a standard, your parents eagerly await your full emergence as yourself, no matter how different you may be from them, or how divergent from their wishes. Yes, there really are people who love like this. Did your parents believe in you? Did they come through for you? Were they reliable? Did they stand up for you? Did they refuse to give up on you no matter what? The psychologist Heinz Kohut wrote, "The more secure a person is regarding his own acceptability, the more certain his sense of who he is, and the more safely internalized his system of values, the more self-confidently and effectively will he be able to offer his love, without undue feelings of rejection and humiliation." Appreciation. Appreciation gives depth to acceptance. "I admire you. I delight in you. I prize you. I respect you. I acknowledge you and all your potential. I appreciate you as unique." To acquire the riches of personal worth and self-confidence, we need just such encouragement. Human evolution proceeds from human accomplishments and consequent validations, but it also proceeds from one person's faith in another's value. A parent's belief that a child has great potential actually engenders that potential in the child. Long-held and continually affirmed belief gives people the capacity to make it come true. Many centuries of belief in the healing power of faith, for instance, make more and more faith healings happen. In this and in all 5 A's, fulfillment of the need instills that quality in the personality. Appreciation also includes gratitude for any kindness or gift we might have or bestow. Appreciation as gratitude recognizes us and how we extend ourselves. Because intimacy is about giving and receiving, appreciation fosters closeness. When we give, we instinctively await a thank you. This is not a middle class or selfish expectation, but a wish that the transaction be completed in the normal way. We know something is missing in a relationship if gratitude is lacking. Is the following description of the mindful appreciation familiar to you? Someone acknowledged and cherished your unconditional worth, without envy or possessiveness, expressing these feelings verbally and nonverbally. The appreciation came as an understanding of what you were capable of or what you felt, validating the mystery of you. It also came as a word of praise, a wink when you did something well, a pat on the shoulder when you excelled, a loving look when you were just yourself. Thanks for something you did or gave or simply were. The ratio of appreciation to complaint in couples that stay together is 5-1, according to the research of psychologist John M. Gottman of the University of Washington in Seattle. Indeed, behind every complaint is a wish for one of the 5 A's. When we blow up or feel dejected, we may be experiencing the lack of one or more of these 5 A's. "I see you are feeling unappreciated" may be an accurate and compassionate response to a partner who is angrily complaining. The next A we consider is affection. To give and receive love is our primary need in life. We express love emotionally, spiritually, and physically. An affectionate touch or hug from someone who really loves us can penetrate our bodies and restore our souls. All our fears, no matter how deep, can be erased by a single loving stroke. Love cannot be defined in a universal way, because our experience of love is ours alone. Just as there is no single universal signature, but only unique personal signatures, so there is no love in general, only unique love, uniquely experienced by each unique person. I learn what love is when I first feel loved. It is then encoded in every cell of my body, and the love I feel later in life may have to replicate that original experience if it is to feel authentic. If I first felt loved by being held when I was hurting, or by being given credit, or by being paid attention to, or by being given things, my body will remember that all my life, and when it happens again, I will feel it as love. I may perceive loving as receiving things, so I keep trying to get others to help me or give me things. Someone may appear to wink at me, and I may take that as love and cling to him, even though he may have only been clearing a speck from his eye. Love in adulthood is a re-experiencing of the love every cell remembers. The way we were loved in early life is the way we want to be loved all our lives. Most of us know just what it takes for us to feel loved. What we have to learn is how to ask for it. A partner is not a mind reader, so it is up to each of us to tell our partner what our brand of love is. And if we have to teach our partner how to love us, we also have to learn how to love him. Knowing this makes it clear that love is not a sentimental feeling, but a conscious choice to give and receive in unique and often challenging ways. Heinz Kohut wrote, "The child's bodily display is responded to with a gleam in his mother's eye." Affection throughout life includes being loved as we look, with our body shape, our style of grooming, our choice of clothes, whether or not they conform to the current model of excellence. Our way of being present is more descriptive of what we are about than anything we have done or do. Intimate contact is with a living presence, not a set of genitals or words that promise love. As adults, we may see a beautiful body and think, "Having that to myself will make me happy." What happened to us that made us so confused as to think our needs could be fulfilled by a pretty face? The word affection comes from affect, feeling. Affection refers to closeness both on the physical and on the feeling level. Physically, it includes the spectrum of touch, from holding to sex. Affection is also a quality of feeling. In this respect, it includes kindliness, considerateness, thoughtfulness, playfulness, and romantic gestures like giving flowers or remembering a special anniversary. Affection flows from a genuine liking of someone. If affection is only a strategy for sex, it is not intimate, but manipulative. In adult relationships, there is intimacy without sex at times, and sex with intimacy always. Affection looks different in the romantic phase of a relationship than it does in the conflict phase. In the former, it may have more of a sexual dimension. In conflict, it may mean patient working through of mutual concerns. Finally, sex is meant to manifest all 5 A's. In healthy relationships, sex is attentive, accepting, appreciative, affectionate, and wildly allowing. As a wise adult, I will know the difference between sex with someone who is doing it the way he does it, and sex with someone who does it in a way that arises from our specific bond. Real love does not come off the rack. It is uniquely tailored by the lover to the beloved. Part of the pain of letting go of someone who really loved you is letting go of being loved in that special way. Affection includes nearness, loving presence. We receive real affection when someone is committed to being beside us often. This does not mean constant cohabitation, but reliable availability. It is the opposite of abandoning and distancing. A child is abandoned every time a parent notices distance and lets it go by without comment or amendment. That child may grow up to say, "I felt abandoned and hurt when mother saw my pain and did not comfort me." Another adult may say, "In my childhood, I felt something was being taken from me when I was hugged or held. So when I'm touched, I'm afraid of losing myself." Contemplating this pain and the pain that caused our parents to act the way they did leads to compassion for ourselves and the other flawed characters in our touching story. Mindfulness is the path to loving presence. Mindful contact is unconditional in granting the five A's, and unconditioned by the creations of the ego, such as fear, demand, expectation, judgment, or control. Is the following description of mindful affection familiar? You are loved the way you are. The need for affection is fulfilled when you are loved unconditionally all the time and genuinely liked most of the time. This loving and liking is demonstrated both verbally and physically. Such love and liking confer a sense of personal power. As Freud said, to enjoy a mother's love is to become a conquistador. In childhood, physical contact has no sexual component or price. This makes it possible to feel safe and prized for who you are, rather than for what you can provide to fulfill the inappropriate needs of a parent. Every cell of your little body knew the difference between being held supportively and being clutched to fulfill a parent's needs. You knew when something was being given and when it was being taken. Compassion is a form of affection. It is love's response to pain. This means being willing to acknowledge pain and caring about how you feel within it. It is a willingness to be in it with yourself. This empathy has a soothing quality, a sure sign of being loved. In fact, the empathy we receive throughout life is the equivalent of parental nurturance. Since your parents' opinion was so crucial to you in early life, to be unloved may make you feel unlovable and responsible for it. Love can later be equated with measuring up to another's standards and can be tied to a sense of obligation. You may feel this way toward partners all your life and never know the ancient story behind it. Finally, as one finger is not the hand, so affection is not love, but only part of it. To be held and cuddled but not allowed later to make choices freely and without blame will soon be revealed as inadequate and untrustworthy. The fifth A, allowing. In a good enough holding environment in early life, I learned that it is safe to be myself, knowing and showing my deepest needs and wishes. This happens in a family with an embrace wide enough to include all of me. Given such a welcome in the world, I gain a sense of stability and coherence, and I develop a reliable source of self-support, a nurturant inner parent who knows how to tolerate my feelings, no matter how contradictory or painful they may be. I reach out for healthy relationships, that is, those that give me all the five A's. But not everyone has the benefit of such a childhood. Some parents set rigid strictures on eating, sleeping, clothing, grooming, all to suit their own needs or standards, rationalizing that such strictures are crucial to a child's health. In our childhood home, it may have felt unsafe to be ourselves. We may have noticed that to be real meant losing the love of those from whom we needed it most. We may then have become whatever others needed us to be, as the price of being loved. The false self that resulted must eventually give way to a truer version if intimacy is ever to work for us. If it was never safe to be ourselves, if we had to conceal what we were, we may not really believe in our talents and virtues now, feeling like imposters and frauds. Trying to live in accord with the needs and wishes of others is like being a cygnet and trying to become a duck just because you find yourself living in a duck pond. The false self is that of a conformist who is a royal heir in hiding. Psychologically healthy adults come from a background of flexibility, not severity. Early needs, like all needs, are best fulfilled in an atmosphere of joy and forgiveness. In such a garden, crocuses ceaselessly pop up, yielding blooms of personal stability and self-nurturing powers, just the qualities that make intimacy possible in later life. Without healthy allowing in childhood, we may choose a controlling partner and tell ourselves, "I have to do it his way or else." We do not notice others' attempts to manipulate us. We can be fooled by a relationship that looks good, but is full of demands and expectations. Yet even standing amid the ashes of continual submission, we may someday find a personal internal liberty, insisting on agreements made bilaterally rather than unilaterally, on cooperation rather than dominance. Submission is compliance with the deepest needs, values, and wishes of others, not our own. But compliance can become defiance. We do not allow others to control us once we are healthy. But we do understand and feel their pain when we realize that control is a compulsion. Most controlling people can't help themselves. They are not in control of the controlling. They are not insulting us by trying to control us. Rather, they automatically take charge and dominate people and situations. They do this because of a chilling fear that they cannot handle letting the chips fall where they may. It takes a spiritual program to be liberated from this compulsion to be controlling and to become compassionate toward controlling people. A higher power than ego has to kick in, because ego will not give itself up easily or become so gently tolerant. The Irish poet William Butler Yeats wrote of the special person who, quote, "loves the pilgrim soul in you," unquote. Mirroring freedom means encouraging the liveliness and passion in others rather than squelching it for our own good or safety. The pilgrim soul also implies going. True allowing means letting someone go. To allow is to stand aside when someone needs space from us or even leaves us. This is an A in courage. Emily Dickinson wrote, "They shut me up in prose, as when a little girl, they put me in the closet because they liked me still." Her poems tell us they did not succeed. Some people just have the pluck to resist control, or they learn it along the path of life, making it impossible for others to prevent their self-emergence. "She won't let me be myself" becomes "she can't stop me." This formula applies to love as well. "He won't let me love him" can become "he can't stop me from loving him." Thus, unconditionality is the profoundest key to personal power. Is the following description of allowing familiar to you? You instinctively seek the full range of motion and emotion in the course of your development. Yet you can feel in the psychological air of your home a heartfelt permission to be yourself, to have your own thoughts and to express them without fear of punishment, to make your own choices, even to step out of line, to go outside the box. You have the freedom to accomplish the two primary tasks of maturation, to separate from your parents, and to develop as a unique person. The relationship is not at risk, no matter what feelings you express. In fact, you think to yourself, "I always knew I could say or feel anything here." You are allowed by your parents to see, tell, touch, talk, be separate, protect yourself, pursue your own talents, relationships, and interests. You do not often hear, "You have no reason to be scared. You had better not get mad or sad or even glad." Or, "How dare you say no When love is the life force of a relationship or family, each member becomes fully complete as himself. This is the alternative to control, which generates a false self. If you didn't receive the gift of freedom, you may have heard things like this. You will never do as well in school as your brother does. As a child, did you feel there's no way to say it? Did you have to ask yourself, what does it take to matter here? Or did you know deep down that all it took was to be yourself? Did your parents represent the world as scary? You always have to be careful instead of, you have it in you to take care of yourself. Go for it. Were you not surprised when you first went to school and felt scared and controlled because you had been taught at home? That's what the world was like. What is the difference between control and limit setting? Control is meant to make you what others need you to be. Limit setting makes it safe for you to be yourself. Paradoxically, we can't achieve freedom without limits. They are the holding environment in which we flourish. Limits are at first the arms around us, and then the word no. Even a sanctuary has gates around it. How else can it provide safety? There is a connection between freedom and self-confidence. When you are kept from expressing your deepest needs and wishes, you lose trust in their validity and in your own judgment. You survive by finding out the rules and following them, thus hiding what you really want. You make it your purpose in life to please others rather than to affirm yourself. If you felt free within your family, you can more easily trust a supportive authority, such as a loving teacher or therapist. Those who show mindful authority without blame or unilateral judgment, the elements of ego that create opposition to authority, we discover what Shakespeare referred to in Measure for Measure. Our own, quote, unknown sovereignty, unquote. Human authority and hierarchy are useful and legitimate when they empower us to take our own initiative, but not when they subjugate and belittle us. When authority, civil or religious, mirrors healthy parenting, it is honorable and wins our respect. Unconditional presence versus the five mindsets of ego. Together, the five A's are the components of unconditional presence. But there are also five major mental habits that interrupt authentic unconditional presence and may cause others to feel unloved. They are virtually involuntary mental reactions that are common to people the world over. These mindsets are like bullies who enter unbidden and intrude upon our pure experience of the present and of the people we meet in the present. The spiritual practice of mindfulness is a rescue from the siege of these invaders. Here are the five fundamental mindsets of ego that interrupt our ability to be here now and also that distort reality. Fear of or worry about a situation or a person. I perceive a threat in you and am afraid you may not like me, so I am on the defensive. Secondly, desire. Desire that this moment or person will meet our demands or expectations, grant us our needed emotional supplies, or fulfill our wishes. I am trying to get something from this or you. Third, judgment. Judgment can take the form of admiration, criticism, humor, moralism, positive or negative bias, censure, labeling, praise, or blame. I am caught up in my own opinion about you or this. Control. Control happens when we force our own view or plan on someone else. I am attached to a particular outcome and am caught in the need to fix, persuade, advise, or change you. Illusion. Illusion overrides reality and may occur as denial, projection, fantasy, hope, idealization, depreciation, or wish. I have a mental picture of or a belief about you or about this, and it obscures what you are really like. The central illusion in life is that of separateness. Any of these five interpretations by the editorial board of ego may be accurate, but they still interfere with our experience of the present. Each is a minimization that imposes our personal dramas upon reality and makes fair witnessing impossible. In this sense, they are the causes of karma. The gate to enlightenment opens when mindfulness closes down the show, even for a moment. The gate to empathy and compassion opens when we see human experience, no matter how unsavory or disfigured, without the mindsets of judgment and fear. At both gates, we pronounce the open sesame, the unconditional yes to reality. The five mindsets, fear, desire, judgment, control, and illusion, are not to be construed as bad. Each of these pirates is full of energy that can be recruited for the invincible ship of mindfulness. The task is not to disown the mindsets, but to redirect their energies so they can serve us and others. Thus, fear can be mined for wise caution. Desire makes it possible to reach out. Judgment includes intelligent assessment. Control is necessary in most daily activities. Fantasy, illusion, is the springboard to the imagination and creativity. When we find the useful kernel of these mindsets, the trespassers can become our bosom buddies. We cannot provide the five A's as long as these five mindsets are engaged, because they distance us from authentic contact and suspend or disable direct perception of reality. Throughout this book, these five mental defenses are referred to as the layers or overlays of ego. We cannot stop our minds from engaging in these distractions, but mindfulness reduces their impact and helps us catch ourselves in the act. Mindfulness is the watchdog, or rather the seeing eye dog of the psyche, watching for the ragers of reality and walking us safely past them. When we come to others with the five A's, we are profoundly present and closeness happens. When we come at others with the five mindsets, we are caught in a personal agenda and distance happens. The commitment to intimacy is a journey from the ego's favorite resorts to the paradise of mindful love. The unconditional presence of someone who loves us harkens back to the past and repairs our childhood sense of being unwanted. At the same time, no human being can or is expected to be fully and unconditionally present all the time. An individual can only offer moments and hours of presence without mindsets. Only pieces of presence can come from beings like us. Kings of shreds and patches. If any one of us were whole and totally satisfactory, we would not be motivated to go on a journey that makes our life so wonderful. Adults have always known this. Religion has responded with a comforting assurance that there is an eternally and unconditionally loving presence, not in pieces, but whole. The mature religious view finds that reality deep within our own souls. Thus, even in the spiritual world, we are hurled back to ourselves, and others are partners, not providers. Finally, keep in mind that it is always acceptable not to know what something is or means. This ability to endure mystery is what the English poet John Keats called negative capability, or, quote, being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts, without irritable reaching after fact and reason, unquote. It is in mindfulness that we act in just that way, enduring our unknowing and yet sitting serenely. From that position, a unique meaning is allowed to ripen over time, in its own time. This is an alternative to the ego's frenzy, to impose a makeshift meaning from its lexicon of standard mindsets. Mindsets are minimizations, since every reality and person is actually an infinite field of potential, a vast open space beyond limit. Without mind-conjured limits, all is perfect and exuberantly provocative, just as it is. Joy is the energy that happens in freedom from mindsets. We no longer feel obliged to figure out what people are up to. We are finally free to be fully mindful. Practices, our skillful means. Practice does not mean forcing yourself to improve, but trusting your potential to open. All the suggestions for practices that follow have a single purpose: to provide a program of skillful means for you. These are the means to become a psychologically healthy and spiritually conscious adult, whether you are alone or in one-to-one relationships. In these practices, psychological and spiritual work are meant to be done not sequentially, but simultaneously. As we do our psychological work, we become more spiritually enlivened. As we engage in spiritual practices, we become more psychologically adept. Couples who work things out together with the help of therapeutic tools can greatly improve the psychological health of their relationship. But spiritual practice together deepens their bond at the level of the soul. Soulmates, after all, are those whose spiritual paths have met. Sitting together in meditation makes as powerful a contribution to bonding as holding one another in a sexual embrace. Because mindfulness is the best tool for communication and for processing issues that arise in a relationship. So to sit is relationship practice, not just spiritual practice. The practice sections in this book consist mainly of leading questions meant to challenge you to face and admit your own truth. They are meant to be answered in your journal and, when appropriate, aloud to your partner. If specific agreements for change can emerge from the responses, so much the better. But do your own work only. Do not attempt to design your partner's program of change, or even judge what she should do or say. You may want to discuss your practices with one person you trust, in addition to your partner, looking for ways to apply what you are learning to your friendships and to your dealings with all people. This program is not only about making your intimate relationships more effective, but also about lighting the way to an efficacious love of everyone. Psychological work and spiritual practices are not ruggedly individual enterprises. Effort is important, but so is grace, the assistance of forces beyond your ego. Enlist and acknowledge the aid of higher powers than ego as you begin each practice. When you trust that your efforts are in the embrace of larger purposes, you feel supported, sustained, and held. The practices show us our vast potential to be healthy adults who know how to love. They also show us where our constrictions in and resistance to love may be lurking. The practices raise our self-esteem as we observe ourselves, activating our potential for love and letting go of our barriers to it. No matter how inadequate or flawed we imagine ourselves to be, we have it in us to find wholeness. The words and practices in this book offer moments of repair and new adjustments that can make pain less impinging or intimidating. The practice sections expand on the ideas and themes that have been explored in each chapter, and should be read whether or not you choose to try the exercises themselves. These sections complement and enhance the text. But also note that you do not need to do all the practices. Some of them are designed for introverts and some for extroverts. Some are tailored to specific problems and therefore do not apply to everyone. But I believe you will find the whole experience of this book much more exciting if you try some practices from each chapter. Choose those that appeal to you, challenge you, or fit your circumstances and personality. You will notice your relationship and yourself being enriched in powerful and touching ways as a result. Finally, be sure to notice your bodily sensations as you read this book and work through the practices. They tell you so much about where your work may be, what holds you back, and what holds you. Practice daily meditation. The first practice is to meditate daily. Begin with a few minutes a day and increase to about 20 as an ideal minimum. It is best to sit together as a couple, but sitting alone is certainly appropriate and valuable also. Sit in a quiet space with your eyes open or closed, your back straight, and your hands on your knees or thighs. Pay attention to your breath. When thoughts or anxieties enter your mind, simply label them as thoughts and return to awareness of your breathing. Do not attempt to stop thinking. The practice requires only that when you notice thought, you return to consciousness of your breath. When your meditation ends, try to get up slowly and see if you can maintain the same sense of awareness throughout the day. Eventually, breath becomes more real and more interesting than our stories. There are a variety of meditation techniques and postures, and it's best to find the meditation style that works for you. Letting go of control. Healthy control means ordering our lives in responsible ways, for example, by maintaining control of a car or of our health. Neurotic control means acting on the compulsive need to make everything and everyone comply with our wishes. Control is what we decided to seek when we noticed the implacable givens of our existence and felt helpless in the face of them. We were not yet able to say, "I will stay with this predicament and see what it has to offer me. I notice I seem to get stronger this way." Saying yes to our experience in this mindful way leads to empowerment. Can you make a decision, a commitment, to be less controlling and to dedicate yourself to this as your present project? Opening to feedback. When you are committed to the work of making yourself a more loving person, you no longer rely on your own brain for all your information. You are happy to learn about yourself from your partner or anyone else you trust. You are open to finding out how you appear to those who see your shadow, that is, your dark side. You want to be exposed, so you can drop your poses and let your authentic self emerge. You welcome feedback about how others are affected by you. A commitment to working on yourself, the whole point of these practices, includes this openness to feedback. Zen master Wu Zhu reports, "The ancients were always so glad to hear of their mistakes. If you find that your ego cannot tolerate being called to task or shown to be inadequate or wrong, then the work begins here. A sine qua non of the work is a willingness to let go of ego. I commit myself to find some truth in any feedback I receive." As a step toward achieving this willingness, ask your partner to describe something that has been upsetting her and notice when you are judging what she says, wanting to control her reactions, feeling afraid of her, wanting to fix her, and so forth. Acknowledge each of these reactions as ego distractions and return to listening openly. When your partner has finished, tell her what distractions interrupted your mindful hearing of her story, and acknowledge them as ego. Make a commitment to notice them in future conversations. You can commit yourself instead to listening with your heart, where the five A's are. How can that happen? By the mindfulness habit you are building in meditation, by returning to your breath, undistracted by mindsets. Here is a practice that uses mindfulness for responding appreciatively and yet self-protectively when someone gives you critical feedback. Approach any person who has an issue with you with a conscious intention to give her the five A's. Say this aloud to her and maintain it in your heart as she speaks. It describes a profoundly loving way to listen, useful at any time of life and in all communication. This is what you would say. I am paying close attention to you right now. I accept you as you are in this moment. I allow you to be yourself. I appreciate you for what you have been and are. I have real affection for you no matter what. Establish eye contact while really listening mindfully, without defensiveness, anger, or plans to retaliate or prove the person wrong. Acknowledge the impact you have had on the other and the feelings you aroused in her. Do not use denial to protect yourself. Do not minimize or discount your impact by contrasting it with your good intentions. The impact matters more than the intention. Commit yourself to taking what the other person says as information, not as censure. Speak up, however, if the feedback includes blame, insult, ridicule, or put-downs. You will not permit that when you are taking care of yourself. Make amends when appropriate, design a plan to change, and ask for support. This practice instills the virtue of humility and makes you more open and endearing. Attending to needs. In the film The Sixth Sense, the main character, a young boy, was released from his fear of the ghosts that haunted him when he finally asked them, "What do you need from me?" Focusing on other people's needs allows us to stop fearing them. Needs come from the heart and are heard by the heart. To listen with the heart is to listen for what someone needs without fear, judgment, criticism, moralism, contradiction, or projection. That is successful communication, and it results from mindfulness. We are present in the here and now without mental interferences. With a mind free of bias, we can really notice when another person needs our attentiveness, acceptance, appreciation, affection, or allowing. Philosopher Martin Buber spoke of the empathic connection, which cannot happen when we are judging, only when we are witnessing. Write out these sentences in your journal and complete each one with as many particulars as you can think of. I see my partner in these same old ways. I believe he or she will never change these behaviors. As long as we believe a partner to be the same as always or to be what we imagine her to be, we operate from that image and not from consciousness of her needs. We can change this mental habit by giving her the 5 A's and really hearing her needs. A person who knows we have pigeonholed her in our minds will not trust us and will therefore not show us her needs. Then communication fails and defensiveness or arguments take over. Using the 5 A's as guideposts, ask yourself what you need most from a partner or friend. Ask your partner or friend what he needs from you. Be careful not to confuse needs with requests, plans, or remedies. For example, to say, "I need you to listen," describes not a need but a request. To say, "I need more space in this relationship," describes not a need but a plan. To say, "I need a drink," describes not a need but your idea of a remedy. Tell your partner your present desires, plans, and ideas for remedies. Then identify the need behind each of these and ask him to hear it. For instance, behind the desire to be listened to may be the need for authentic attentiveness, an undistracted focus on your words and feelings with respect and sincere appreciation. Feeling loved. Begin this exercise by recalling memories of feeling loved in childhood. And notice any connections to the kinds of love you seek as an adult. Then ask your partner what feels like love to him, and share what it feels like to you. You may not feel loved by someone who truly loves you, because she shows it in ways you do not understand as love. This is like hearing a foreign language and presuming it is gibberish. Ask for a translation. The challenge of intimacy for adults is to expand our original concept of love to accommodate a partner's unique way of loving. We can still ask for what we want while trying to accept an approximation of it and opening ourselves to new versions of love. Consider these questions in your journal. What feels like love to me? who makes me feel that way? Do I feel loved in bodily, resonant ways by my partner? Who was the first person in my life to make me feel loved? Have I thanked him or her enough? Can I tell my partner what feels like love to me? Can I ask her the same question? What will I do with the information? Is the love I offer childlike, parental, or adult? Is the love I seek childlike, parental, or adult? When we feel little or no love coming our way, we may look for a proof of love. The more proofs we seek, the more our partner feels threatened, tested, and on the spot. Am I in any of these positions? The touch. Becoming an adult does not erase or cancel our fundamental needs. We all feel a need to be held at times, no matter what our age. This comes from an instinct for personal validation. We are always on the lookout for the mirroring and holding that may have been inadequate or missing in early life. When someone loves us, cares about us, and respects us, that person's body becomes a resource for repair of the neglect or abuse in our past. Some of us fear, quite reasonably, the letdown of finding closeness and then losing it again. We want to be sure a potential partner deserves our trust, and it is always a gamble. If we can get past the inhibiting fear, we may open ourselves to the touch of others, however limited, and find it holds a healing power. Being held with tender attention, for example, in someone's lap or side by side, with arms around each other, supplies the mirroring love that may have been missing in our childhood. It feels embarrassing only at first, but once the ice is broken, it feels natural. Try this kind of holding sometime with your partner or close friend. You may offer to hold a partner on your lap or cuddle side by side. We do not outgrow the need for such comforting forms of childhood closeness, and there is no shame in it. Offering support. Emotional support means a generous giving of the five A's. Yet, how do we know exactly what kind of support a partner needs in a given moment or situation? For instance, our partner is weeping. Will it help most to hold her or give her space? The little prince acknowledged, "It's such a secret place, the land of tears." There is sometimes a recondite, unreachable, unnamed feeling in a person's experience. She herself does not know what she really feels or needs in the moment. Support may consist simply in honoring that inner mystery. We may not find out how to help. Then, like Hamlet, we can only say, "Sit still, my soul." At other times, sensitivity may take the form of inquiry. When your partner seems distressed and willing to communicate, practice asking her what kind of help she needs. This is a way of honoring and encouraging her comfortableness in asking for support from you, another contribution to intimacy. Here are some examples of how to ask. "I see your pain. Please tell me how I can be here for you now. I want to support you in this moment. Please let me know what will work best for you. I am available to you in any way I can be. How can I nurture you best at this time? If you do not know what you need right now, I can simply be here with you." Noticing mindsets. Loving presence takes five forms: attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. Mindfulness is the path to such loving presence. Mindful contact is unconditional in granting these five A's and is unconditioned by the mindsets of ego, such as fear, demand, expectation, judgment, or control. Look at the chart below and journal examples of how you find yourself on both sides in your way of relating to a partner. Show your results to your partner and ask for feedback in making changes and for a compassionate response, too. Being attentive is offset by ignoring, refusing to listen, being unavailable, and fearing the truth. Being accepting is offset by trying to make someone over to fit our specifications, desires, or fantasies. Being appreciative is offset by criticizing. Being affectionate is offset by acting selfishly or abusively. allowing is offset by being controlling, demanding, or manipulative. Spiritual commitment to the five A's. The five A's are purposes or ends in themselves. Giving and receiving them are not only the ways we are fulfilled, but also the spiritual practices by which we fulfill our heroic destiny